Chapter 5. They flew from the white towers of Crine Lamia to the fading fires of Lartain in a lonely silence, not touching, both thinking their own thoughts. Gwen left the air car in its usual place on the roof, and Dirk followed her downstairs to her door. "Wait," she said in a quick whisper, when he had expected her to say good night. She vanished inside. He waited, puzzled. There were noises from the other side of the door. Voices. Then abruptly Gwen was back, pressing a thick manuscript into his hand, an impressively heavy mass of paper hand-bound in black leather. Jan's thesis. He had almost forgotten. "Read it," she whispered, leaning out the door. "Come up tomorrow morning, and we'll talk some more." She kissed him lightly on the cheek and closed the heavy door with a small click. Dirk stood for a moment turning the bound manuscript over in his hands, then turned toward the tubes. He was only a few steps down the hall when he heard the first shout. Then, somehow, he could not continue. The sounds drew him back, and he stood listening at Gwen's door. The walls were thick, and very little of what was said came through. The words and the meanings he lost entirely, but the voices themselves carried, and the tones. Gwen's voice dominated, loud, sharp-edged. At times she was shouting, close to the edge of hysteria. In his mind, Dirk could see her pacing the living room before the gargoyles, the way she always paced when she was angry. Both of the Cavalars would be present, berating her. Dirk was sure he heard two other voices, one quiet and sure, without anger, questioning relentlessly. That had to be Jan Vickery. His cadence gave him away, the rhythm of his speech distinctive even through the wall. The third voice, Garth Janicek, spoke him frequently at first, then more and more, with increasing volume and anger. After a time, the quiet male voice was virtually silent, while Gwen and Garth screamed at one another. Then it said something, a sharp command, and Dirk heard a noise, a fleshy thud, a blow, someone hitting someone. It could be nothing else. Finally, Vickery giving orders, followed by silence. The light went off inside the room. Dirk stood quietly, holding Vickery's manuscript and wondering what to do. There did not seem to be anything he could do except talk to Gwen the next morning and find out who had hit her and why. I had to be Janicek, he thought. Ignoring the tubes, he decided to walk downstairs to Ruach's rooms. Once in bed, Dirk found he was immensely tired and badly shaken by the events of the day. So much all at once, he could hardly cope with it. The Cavalar hunters and their mockmen, the strange bitter life Gwen lived with Vickery and Janicek, the sudden dizzy possibility of her return. Unable to sleep, he thought about it all for a long time. Ruach was already asleep. There was no one to talk to. Finally, Dirk picked up the thick manuscript Gwen had given him and began to leaf through the first few pages. There was nothing like a good chunk of scholarly writing to put a man to sleep, he reflected. 4 hours and half a dozen cups of coffee later, he put down the manuscript, yawned, and rubbed his eyes. Then he shut off the light and stared at the darkness. Jan Vickery's thesis, Myth and History, Origins of Holdfast Society as based on an interpretation of the demon song cycle of James Lyon Tal, was a worse indictment of his people than anything that Ark and Ruach could possibly say, Dirk thought. He had laid it all out, with sources and documentation from the computer banks on Avalon, with lengthy quotations from the poetry of James Lyon Tal, and even lengthier dissertations on what James Tal had meant. All of the things that he and Gwen had told Dirk that morning were there, in detail. Vickery supplied theories on theories, attempted to explain everything. He even explained the Mockmen, more or less. He argued that during the time of fire and demons, some survivors from the cities had reached the mining camps and sought shelter. Once taken in, however, they proved dangerous. Some were victims of radiation sickness. They died slowly and horribly and possibly passed the poison on to those who nursed them. Others, seemingly healthy, lived and became part of the proto-holdfast until they married and produced children. Then the taint of radiation showed up. It was all conjecture on Vickery's part, with not even a line or two from James Lyon to support it, yet it seemed a glib and plausible rationalization of the Mockman myth. Vickery also wrote at length of the event the Cavalars called the Sorrowing Plague, and what he carefully called the shift to contemporary Kavalar sexual familial patterns. According to his hypothesis, Harangans had returned to High Kavalan approximately a century after their first raid. The cities they had bombed were still slag. There was no sign of new building on the part of the humans. Yet the three slave races they had dropped to seed the planet were nowhere in evidence, decimated, extinct. Undoubtedly, the Harangan mind commanding concluded that some of the humans still lived. To effect a final wiping up, the Harangans dropped plague bombs. That was Vickery's theory. Jamis Lyon's poems had no mention of Harangans, but many mentions of sickness. All the surviving Kavalar accounts agreed on that. There was a sorrowing plague, a long period when one horrible epidemic after another swept through the holdfasts. Each turn of the season brought a new and more dreadful disease, the ultimate demon enemy, one the Kavalars could not fight or kill. 90 men died out of every 100, 90 men and 99 women. One of the many plagues, it seemed, was female selective. The medical specialists Vickery had consulted on Avalon had told him that based on the meager evidence he gave them, a few ancient poems and songs, it seemed likely that the female sex hormones acted as a catalyst for the disease. Jamis Lyon-Tahl had written that the young maids were spared the bloody wasting because of their innocence, while the rutting Ayn Kethi were struck down horribly and died in shuddering convulsions. Vickery interpreted this to mean that prepubescent girls were left untouched, while sexually mature women were devastated. An entire generation was wiped out. Worse, the disease lingered. No sooner did girl children reach puberty than the plague struck. Jamis Lyon made this a truth of vast religious significance. Some women escaped, the naturally immune. Very few at first. More later, because they lived producing sons and daughters, many of whom were also immune, while those who did not share the resistance died at puberty. Eventually all Kavalars were immune, with rare exceptions. The sorrowing plague ended. But the damage had been done. Entire holdfasts had been wiped out. Those that clung to life had seen their populations decline far below the numbers necessary to maintain a viable society. And the social structure and sexual roles had been warped irrevocably away from the monogamous egalitarianism of the early Taran colonists. Generations had grown to maturity in which men outnumbered women 10 to 1. Little girls lived all through childhood with the knowledge that puberty might mean death. It was a grim time. On that both Jan Vickery and Jamis Lyon-Tahl spoke with one voice. Jamis Lyon wrote that Sin had finally passed from High Kavalan, when the Ayn Kethi were safely locked away from the daylight, back in their caves from which they had issued, where their shame could not be seen. Vickery wrote that the Kavalar survivors had fought back as best they could. They no longer had the technological skills to construct airtight sterilized chambers, but no doubt rumors of such places had drifted down the years to them, and they still hoped that such places could be proof against disease. So the surviving women were secured in prison-like hospitals deep under the ground, in the safest part of the holdfast, and the farthest from the contaminated wind and rain and water. Men who had once roamed and hunted and warred with their wives by their sides now teamed with other men, both grieving for lost partners. To relieve their sexual tensions and maintain the gene pool as best they could, if they even understood such things, the men who lived through the sorrowing plague made their women sexual property of all. To ensure as many children as possible, they made them perpetual breeders who lived their lives safe from danger and in constant pregnancy. The holdfast that did not adopt such measures failed to survive. Those that did passed on a cultural heritage. Other changes took root as well. Tara had been a religious world, home of the Irish-Roman Reformed Catholic Church, and the urge to monogamy died hard. The patterns appeared in two mutated forms. The strong emotional attachments that grew up between male hunting partners became the basis for the intense total relationship of Tain and Tain, while those men who desired a semi-exclusive bond with a woman created Bethanes by capturing females from other holdfasts. The leaders encouraged such raidings, Jan Vickery said. New women meant new blood, more children, a larger population, and thus a better chance of survival. It was unthinkable that any man take exclusive possession of one of the Iron Kethi. But a man who could bring a woman in from outside was rewarded with honors and a seat in the councils of leadership, and perhaps most importantly, the woman herself. These were the likely events, Vickery argued, self-evident truths that produced modern Kabbalah society. Jamis Lion-Tal, wandering the face of the world many generations later, had been so much a child of his culture that he was unable to conceive of a world in which women held any status other than what he saw, and when he was forced to think otherwise by the folklore he collected, he thought the idea intolerably wicked. Thus he rewrote all the oral literature as he cast his demon song cycle. He transformed K. Iron Smith into a thundering giant of a man, made the sorrowing plague a ballad of Iron Kethi wickedness, and generally created the impression that the world had always been the way he found it. Later poets built on the foundations he had laid. The forces that had produced the Holdfast Society of High Kavalan had long ago vanished. Today, women and men numbered roughly the same. The epidemics were only grisly fables. Most of the dangers of the planet's surface had been conquered. Nonetheless, the Holdfast coalitions continued. The men fought duels and studied the new technology, and worked on the farms and in the factories and sailed the Kavalar starships, while the Iron Kethi lived in vast subterranean barracks as sexual partners for all the men of the Holdfast, laboring at whatever tasks the High Bond Councils deemed safe and suitable, and having babies, though fewer now. Kavalar population was strictly controlled. Other women lived slightly freer lives under the protection of jade and silver, but not many. A Bethane had to come from outside the Holdfast, which in practice meant an ambitious youngster had to challenge and kill a High Bond of another coalition, or lay claim to one of the Iron Kethi in an enemy Holdfast and face a defender chosen in council. The second route was rarely successful. High Bond councils invariably chose the Holdfast's most accomplished duelist to champion the Iron Kethi. In fact, the designation was a singular honor. A man who did succeed in winning a Bethane immediately took his high names and his place among the rulers. It was said that he had given his Kethi the gift of two bloods, the blood of death, a slain enemy, and the blood of life, a new woman. The woman enjoyed the status of jade and silver until such time as her High Bond was killed. If he was slain by one of his own Holdfast, she became an Iron Kethi. If the killer was an outsider, she passed to him. Such was the status that Gwendol Varno had taken when she clasped Jan's bracelet around her wrist. Dirk lay awake for a long time, thinking of everything he had read and staring up at the ceiling, growing more and more angry the more he thought. By the time the first dawn light began to filter slowly through the window above his head, he had decided. In a sense, it no longer mattered if Gwen returned to him or not, so long as she left Vickery and Janasek and the whole sick society of High Kavalan. But alone, she could not make the break, much as she might wish to. Very well, then. Arkin Ruach was right. He would help her. He would help her to be free, and afterwards there would be time to consider their own relationship. Finally, his resolve fixed firmly in his mind, Dirk slept. It was midday when he awoke, suddenly with a snap of guilt. He sat up and blinked and remembered he had promised Gwen that he would come up that morning, and here the morning was gone and he had overslept. Hurriedly he rose and dressed, looked around briefly for Ruach. The Kimdisi was gone, no clue as to where or for how long, and then went up to Gwen's apartment, Vickery's thesis tucked firmly under his arm. Gas Janasek answered his knock. Yes, the red-bearded Kavalar said, frowning. He was bare to the waist, dressed only in snug-fitting black trousers and the eternal bracelet of iron and glowstone on his right arm. Dirk saw at a glance why Janasek did not wear the sort of V-neck shirts that Vickery seemed to favor. The left side of his chest, from his armpit to his breast, bore a long, crooked scar, slick and hard. Janasek saw his stare. A duel that went wrong, he snapped. I was too young. It will not happen again. Now, what do you require? Dirk flushed. I want to see Gwen, he said. She's not here, Janasek said, his eyes hard and unfriendly. He started to shut the door. Wait, Dirk stopped the door with his hand. More, what is it? Gwen, I was supposed to see her. Where is she? In the wilderness, Talarian. I would be pleased if you would remember that she is an ecologist, sent here by the High Bonds of Ironjade to do important work. She has neglected that work for 2 full days to guide you hither and yon. Now, as is proper, she has returned to it. She and Arkenruak took their instruments and went off into the forests. Well, she didn't say anything last night, Dirk insisted. She is not required to inform you of her plans, Janasek said. Nor must she secure your permission for anything. There is no bond between you. Remembering the argument he had overheard the night before, Dirk was suddenly suspicious. Can I come in? He said. I want to give this back to Jan. Talk to him about it, he added, showing Garth the leather-bound thesis. Actually, he hoped to look for Gwen, to find out if she was being kept from him. But it would hardly have been polite to say this. Janasek was dripping hostility, and an attempt to push past him would be very unwise. Jan is not presently at home. No one is here but me. I am about to leave. He reached out and snatched the thesis from Dirk's hands. I will take this, however. Gwen should never have given it to you. Hey, Dirk said. He had an impulse. The history was very interesting, he said suddenly. Can I come in and talk to you about it? A second or two, I won't keep you. Abruptly, Janasek seemed to change. He smiled and gave way, beckoning Dirk into the apartment. Dirk looked around quickly. The living room was deserted, the fireplace cold. Nothing seemed amiss or out of place. The dining room, visible through an open archway, was also empty. The whole apartment was very quiet, no sign of Gwen or Jan. From what he could see, it appeared Janasek had been telling the truth. Uncertain, Dirk wandered across the room, pausing before the mantel and its gargoyles. Janasek watched him wordlessly, then turned and left, returning shortly. He had strapped on his mesh steel belt with its heavy holster and was buttoning up the front of a faded black shirt when he re-entered. Where are you going? Dirk asked. Out, Janasek replied with a brief grin. He undid the latch flap of his holster and drew out the laser pistol within, checked the power reading on the side of its butt, then reholstered and drew again, a smooth, flowing motion with his right hand, and sighted down on Dirk. Do I alarm you? He asked. Yes, Dirk said. He moved away from the mantle. Janasek's grin came back again. He slid the laser into its holster. I am quite good with a dueling laser, he said, though in truth my Tain is better. Of course, I must use only my right arm. The left still pains me. The scar tissue pools, so the chest muscles on that side cannot move so far or so easily as those on my right. Yet it matters little. I am chiefly right-handed. The right arm is always more than the left, you know. His right hand rested on the laser pistol as he spoke, and the glowstones in their black iron setting shone like dim red eyes along his forearm. It's too bad about your injury. I made a mistake, Talarian. I was too young, perhaps, but my mistake was nonetheless serious for my age. And such mistakes can be very grave matters, and in some ways I escaped easily. He was staring very fixedly at Dirk. One should be careful that one does not make mistakes. Oh? Dirk affected an innocent smile. For a time Janasek did not reply. Then finally he said, I think you know what I am speaking about. Do I? Yes. You are not an unintelligent man, Talarian. Nor am I. Your childish ruses do not amuse me. You have nothing to discuss with me, for example. You simply wanted to gain admittance to this chamber for some reasons of your own. Dirk's smile vanished. He nodded. All right. A lousy trick, clearly, since you saw right through it. I wanted to look for Gwen. I told you she was out in the wild, at work. I don't believe you, Dirk said. She would have said something to me yesterday. You're keeping me from her. Why? What's going on? Nothing that need concern you, said Janasek. Understand me, Talarian, if you will. Perhaps to you, as to Arkan Ruic, I seem an evil man. You may think that of me. I care very little. I am not an evil man. That is why I warn you against mistakes. That is why I admitted you. Though I know full well that you have nothing to say to me, for I have things to say to you. Dirk leaned against the back of the couch and nodded. All right, Janicek. Go ahead. Janicek frowned. Your problem, Telerian, is that you know little and understand less of Jan and myself and our world. I know more than you think. Do you? You have read Jan's writings on the Demon Song, and no doubt people have told you things. Yet what is that? You are no Kavalar. You do not understand Kavalars, I would guess, yet you stand here and I see judgment in your eyes. By what right? Who are you to judge us? You scarcely know us. I will give you an instance. Just a second ago you called me Janicek. Well, that's your name, isn't it? That is part of my name. The last part, the least and smallest part of who I am. It is my chosen name, the name of an ancient hero of the Iron Jade Gathering who lived a long and fruitful life, many times honorably defending his holdfast and his kethi in high war. I know why you use it, of course. On your world and in your naming system, it is customary to address those toward whom you feel distance or hostility by the final component of their names. An intimate you would call by his first name, would you not? Dirk nodded. More or less, it's not quite that simple, but you're close enough. Janicek smiled thinly. The blue eyes seemed to sparkle. You see, I do understand you people only too well. I give you the benefit of your own ways. I call you Telerian because I am hostile to you, and that is correct. You do not reciprocate, however. You address me as Janicek, without an instant of thought or concern, quite deliberately imposing your own naming system on me. What should I call you then? Gas? Janicek made a sharp, impatient gesture. Gas is my true name, but it is not proper from you. In Kavalar custom, use of that name alone would indicate a relationship that does not in fact exist between us. Gas is a name for my Tain and my crow Bethane and my Kethi, not for an off-worlder. Properly, you should call me Gas Ironjade, and my Tain Jantany High Ironjade. Those are traditional and correct from an equal, a Kavalar from another house with whom I am on speaking terms. I give you the benefit of many doubts, he smiled. Now understand, Telerian, that I tell you this as an illustration only. I care precious little whether you call me Gas or Gas Ironjade or Mr. Janicek. Call me whatever makes your heart happiest, and I will take no insult. The Kimdisi Arkan Ruic has even been known to call me Garsi. Yet I have resisted the urge to prick him and see if he pops. These matters of courtesy and address, I do not need Jan to tell me that they are old things, legacies of days both more elaborate and more primitive, dying in this modern time. Today Kavalars sail ships from star to star, talk and trade with creatures we would once have exterminated as demons, even shape planets as we have shaped Warlorn. Old Kavalar, the language of the Holdfasts for thousands of your standard years, is scarcely spoken any more. Though a few terms linger on and will continue to linger, since they name realities that can be named only clumsily, or not at all in tongues of the Star Travelers, realities that would soon vanish if we gave up their names, the old Kavalar terms. Everything has changed, even we of High Kavalan. And Jan says that we must change still more if we are to fulfill our destiny in the histories of man. Thus the old rules of names and name bonds break down, and even high bonds grow lax in their speech, and Jantany High Ironjade goes about calling himself Jan Vickery. If it doesn't matter, Dirk said, then what's your point? The point was illustration, Telerian. A simple and elegant illustration of how much of your own culture you wrongly presume to be part of ours, of how much you press your judgments and your values on us with every word and action. That was the point. There are more important matters in question, but the pattern is the same. You make the same mistake, a mistake you ought not to make. The price might be greater than you can afford. Do you think I don't know what you are trying to do? What am I trying to do? Janicek smiled again, his eyes small and hard, tiny wrinkles creasing the skin at their corners. You try to take Gwen Del Vano away from my Tane. Truth. Dirk said nothing. It is truth, Janasek said, and it is wrong. Understand that it will never be permitted. I will not permit it. I am bonded by iron and fire to Jantany High Iron Jade, and I do not forget that. We are Tane, and Tane, we too. No bond that you have ever known is as strong. Dirk found himself thinking of Gwen, and of a deep red teardrop full of memories and promises. He thought it a pity that he could not give the Whisper Jewel to Janasek to hold for a moment, so the arrogant Kevlar could taste just how strong a bond Dirk had had with his Jenny. But such a gesture would be useless. Janasek's mind would have no resonances with the patterns Esper etched in the stone. It would be only a gem to him. I loved Gwen, he said sharply. I doubt that any bond of yours is more than that. Do you? Well, you are no Kevlar, no more than Gwen is. You do not understand the iron and fire. I first encountered Jantany when each of us was quite young. I was even younger than he, in truth. He was fond of play with children younger than himself rather than his age-mates, and he came frequently to our creche. I held him in great esteem from the first, as only a boy can, because he was older than me, and thus closer to being a high bond, and because he led me on adventures into strange corridors and caves, and because he told fascinating stories. When I was older, I learned why he came among the younger children so often, and I was shocked and shamed. He was afraid of those as old as he, because they taunted him and often beat him. Yet by the time I learned that, a bond existed between us. You might call it friendship, but you would be wrong to do so. You would be imposing your own concepts on our lives once more. It was more than your off-worlder friendship. There was iron between us already, although we were not yet Tane and Tane. The next time Jan and I went exploring together, we were far beyond our holdfast in a cavern he knew well. I surprised him and beat him until every part of his flesh was bruised and swollen. He did not visit my age barracks for the entire winter, yet at last he returned. We had no bitterness between us. We began to roam and hunt together once more, and he told me more stories, tales of myths and history. For my part, I would assault him randomly, always catching him unready and overwhelming him. In time he began to fight back, and well. In time it became impossible for me to surprise him with my fists. One day I smuggled a knife out from Iron Jade beneath my shirt and bared it on Jan and cut him. Then we both began to carry knives. When he reached his adolescence, the age where he would pick his chosen names and become subject to the Code Duello, Jantany was no longer a subject of easy taunt. He was always unpopular. You must understand that he was ever a questioning sort, given to uncomfortable inquiries and unorthodox opinions, a lover of history but openly contemptuous of religion, with much too much unhealthy interest in the off-worlders who moved among us. As such, he was challenged again and again that first year he attained dueling age. He always won. When I reached adolescence a few years later, and we became Tane and Tane, I had scarcely anyone to fight. Jantany had put fear in all of them, so they would not challenge us. I was very disappointed. Since that time we have dueled together often. We are bonded for life, and we have been through much. And I do not care to hear you spout comparisons with this meaningless love you off-worlders are so enchanted by, this mock-man bond that comes and goes with a whim of a moment. Jantany himself was badly corrupted by the concept during his years on Avalon. And that was in some measure my responsibility, because I let him go alone. It was true that on Avalon I would have had no function and no place, yet I should have been there. I failed Jan in that. I will never fail him again. I am his Tane, and always his Tane, and I will permit no one to kill him, or wound him, or twist his mind, or steal his name. These things are my bond and my duty. Too often these days Jan lets his very name be threatened by such as you and Ruach. Jan is in many ways a perverse and dangerous man, and the quirks of his mind often bring us into peril. Even his heroes. I remembered one day some of the stories he had told me in childhood, and was struck by the fact that all of Jan's favorite heroes were solitary men who suffered ultimate defeat. Arryn High Glowstone, as an instance, who dominated an entire epoch of history. He ruled by force of personality the most powerful holdfast High Cavalan ever knew, the Glowstone Mountain. And when his enemies leagued against him in High War, all hands raised against his, he put swords and shields on the arms of his Ain Kethi and took them to battle to swell the size of his army. His foes were broken and humiliated, and so Jan would tell me the story. Yet later I learned that Arryn High Glowstone won no victory at all. So many of his holdfasts, Ain Kethi, were slain that day, that few remained to birth new warriors. Glowstone Mountain declined steadily in power and in population. And 40 years after Arryn's bold stroke, the Glowstones fell, and Highborns from Tarl and Ironjade and Bronzefist took their women and children, leaving the halls abandoned. The truth of Arryn High Glowstone is that he was a failure, and a fool, and one of history's pariahs, and such are all Jan's mad heroes. Arryn sounds heroic enough to me, Dirk said sharply. On Avalon, we'd probably credit him with freeing the slaves, even if he didn't win. Janicek glowered at him, his eyes like blue sparks set in his narrow skull. He tugged at his red beard in annoyance. Talarian, that comment is precisely what I warned you of. Ain Kethi are not slaves. They are Ain Kethi. You judge wrongly, and your translations are false. According to you, Dirk said. According to Ruat, Ruark. Janicek's tone was contemptuous. Is the Kimdisi the source of all your information about High Cavalan? I see that I've wasted time and words on you, Talarian. You are already poisoned, and you have no interest in understanding. You were the tool of the manipulators of Kimdis. I will lecture you no more. Fine, Dirk said. Just tell me where Gwen is. I told you. When will she be back, then? Late. And then she will be tired. I'm certain that she will not wish to see you. You are keeping her from me. Janicek was silent for a moment. Yes, he said, finally, his mouth grim. It is the best course, Talarian. For you, as well as her, although I do not expect you to believe that. You have no right. In your culture, I have every right in mine. And you will not be alone with her again. Gwen is not part of your damn sick Kavalar culture, Dirk said. She was not born into it, yet she took the jade and silver, and the name Bethane. Now she is Kavalar. Dirk was trembling, his control gone. What does she say to that? He demanded, stepping closer to Janicek. What did she say last night? Did she threaten to leave? He jabbed the Kavalar with his finger. Did she say she was coming with me? Was that it? And you hit her and carried her off? Janicek frowned and brushed Kirk's hand away forcefully. So you spy on us, too. You do it poorly, Talarian. But it is offensive nonetheless. A second mistake. The first was Jan's in telling you the things he did, in trusting you, and in lending you his protection. I don't need anyone's protection, so you say. An idiot's misplaced pride. Only those who are strong should reject the protections given the weak. Those who are truly weak need them. He turned away. I will waste no more time with you, he said, walking toward the dining chamber. There was a thin black carrying case lying on the table. Janicek opened it, clicking back both locks simultaneously and flipping up the lid. Inside, Dirk saw 5 rows of the black iron banshee pins on red felt. Janicek held one up. Are you quite certain that you do not want one of these? Corariel? He grinned. Dirk crossed his arms and did not dignify the question with an answer. Janicek waited a moment for a reply. When none came, he slipped the banshee pin back into its place and closed the case. The jelly children are not so choosy as you are, he said. Now I must bring these to Jan. Get out of here. It was early afternoon. The hub burned dimly in the center of the sky, with the scattered small lights of the four visible Trojan suns arrayed unevenly around it. A strong wind was blowing from the east, building into a gale, it seemed. Dust swirled through the gray and scarlet alleys. Dirk sat on one corner of the roof, his legs hanging out over the street, mulling his possibilities. He had followed Garst Janicek up to the airlot and had seen him depart, carrying the case of Banshees and flying his massive squared-off military relic in its olive-green armor. The other two air cars, the gray Manta Wing and the bright yellow Teardrop, were gone as well. He was stranded here in Lartain with no idea of where Gwen was or what they were doing to her. He wished briefly that Ruark was somewhere around. He wished he had an air car of his own. No doubt he could have rented one in Challenge, if he had thought of it, or even at the spacefield the night he'd come in. Instead, he was alone and helpless. Even the sky scoots were missing. The world was red and gray and pointless. He wondered what to do. Abruptly it came to him as he sat and thought about air cars. The festival cities he had seen were all very different, but they had one thing in common. None of them had nearly enough landing space to accommodate an air car population equal to their human population, which meant the cities had to be linked by some other kind of transportation network, which meant that maybe he had some freedom of action after all. He got up and went to the tubes, and then down to Ruark's quarters in the base of the tower. Between two black-barked ceiling-high plants in earthenware pots, a wall screen waited, just as he remembered seeing it, dark and unlit, as it had been since Dirk arrived. There were very few people left on Warlorn to call or be called, but no doubt there was an information circuit. He studied the double row of buttons beneath the screen, selected one, and punched. The darkness gave way to a soft blue light, and Dirk breathed a little easier. The communications grid, at least, was still operational. One of the buttons was marked with a question mark. He tried it and was rewarded. The blue light cleared, and suddenly the screen was full of small script, 100 numbers for 100 basic services, everything from medical aid and religious information to off-planet news. He punched the sequence for visitor transport. Figures flowed across the screen, and one by one Dirk's hopes withered. There were air car rental facilities at the spacefield and at 10 of the 14 cities, all closed. The functional air cars had left Warlorn with the festival crowds. Other cities had provided hovercraft and hydrofoil boats, no longer. At Muskwell-by-the-Sea, visitors could sail up coast and down in a genuine wind-powered ship from the Forgotten Colony. Service terminated. The intercity Airbus line was closed down, the nuclear-powered stratoliners of Toba, and the helium dirigibles of Ashelin were all grounded and gone. The wall screen showed him a map of the high-speed subways that had run from beneath the spacefield out to each of the cities, but the map was drawn all in red, and the legend below it explained that red meant depowered, no longer operational. There was no transportation left on Warlorn except walking, it seemed, plus whatever late visitors had brought with them. Dirk scowled and killed the readout. He was about to turn off the screen when another thought hit him. He punched for library and got a query sign and instructions. Then he coded in jelly children and define. He waited. It was a short wait, and he hardly needed the vast bulk of information the library threw at him. The details of history and geography and philosophy. The critical information he took in quickly, the rest he disregarded. Jelly Children, it seemed, was a popular nickname for the followers of a pseudo-religious drug cult on the world of the Black Wine Ocean. They were so called because they spent years at a time living in the cavernous inner dampness of kilometer-long gelatinous slugs that crept with infinite slowness along the bottom of their seas. The cultists called the creatures mothers. The mothers fed their children with sweet hallucinogenic secretions and were believed to be semi-sentient. The belief, Dirk noted, did not stop the jelly children from killing their host when the quality of her dream secretions began to decline, which invariably happened as the slugs aged. Free of one mother, the Jelly children would then seek another. Quickly, Dirk cleared the screen of that data and consulted the library again. The world of the Black Wine Ocean had a city on Warlorn. It lay beneath an artificial lake 50 kilometers around, under the same dark, teeming waters that covered the surface of the Black Winer's homeworld. It was called the City in the Starless Pool, and the surrounding lake was full of life forms brought in for the Festival of the Fringe, including mothers, no doubt. Out of curiosity, Dirk found the city on a map of Warlorn. He had no way of getting there, of course. He killed the wall screen and walked into the kitchen to mix himself a drink. As he tossed it down, it was a thick off-white milk from some Kindisi animal, very cold, bitter, but refreshing. He drummed his fingers very impatiently on the bar. The restlessness was growing in him, the urge to do something. He felt trapped here, waiting for one of the others to return, not knowing which it would be or what would happen then. It seemed as though he had been moved back and forth at the whim of others ever since he had first come down on the shuddering of forgotten enemies. He had not even come of his own volition. Gwen had called him with her whisper jewel, although she hardly seemed to welcome him when he arrived. That, at least, he had begun to understand. She was trapped in a very complex web, a web that was political and emotional at the same time. And he seemingly had been pulled in with her, to stand helpless while half-understood storms of psychosexual and cultural tension swirled all around them. He was very tired of standing helpless. Abruptly, he thought of Crine Lamia. In a windswept landing deck, two air cars sat abandoned. Dirk put his glass down thoughtfully, wiped his lip with the back of his hand, and went back to the wall screen. It was a simple matter to find the location of all air car landing facilities in Lartain. There were air lots atop all of the larger residential towers, and a big public garage deep within the rock beneath the city. The garage, the city directory informed him, could be reached from any of the 12 undertubes spaced evenly through Lartain. Its concealed doors opened in the middle of the plunging cliff that loomed above the common. If the Cavalars had left any air cars at all in the shell of their city, that was where he would find them. He took the tubes down to the ground level and the street. Fat Satan had climbed past Zenith and was sinking toward the horizon. The glowstone streets were faded and black where the red gloom fell. But when Dirk walked through the shadows between the square ebon towers, he could still see the cold fires of the city beneath his feet. The soft red glow of the rock, fading yet still persisting. In the open, he himself threw shadows, dim, dark wraiths that piled clumsily atop one another, almost but not quite coinciding, and scuttled too swiftly at his heels to wake the sleeping glowstones into life. He saw no one else during his walk, although he wondered uneasily about the wraiths, and once he passed what must have been a dwelling. It was a square building with a domed roof and black iron pillars at its door, and chained to one of those pillars was a hound that stood taller than Dirk, with bright red eyes and a long, hairless face that reminded him somehow of a rat's. A creature was worrying a bone, but it stood when he walked past and growled deep in its throat. Whoever lived in that building clearly did not relish the idea of visitors. The undertube still functioned. He fell and daylight vanished, and he got out again in the lower passages, where Lartain had the greatest resemblance to the holdfasts of High Cavalan itself. Echoing stone halls with wrought iron hangings, metal doors everywhere, chambers within chambers, a fastness in stone, Ruark had said once, a fortress, no part of which could be taken easily, but now abandoned. The garage was multi-leveled and dimly lit, with space enough for 1,000 air cars on each of its 10 levels. Dirk wandered through the dust for a half an hour before he found even one. It was useless to him. Another beast car, fashioned of blue-black metal in the grotesque likeness of a giant bat. It was more realistic and frightening than Jan Vickery's rather stylized Manta Banshee. But it was also a burnt-out hulk. One of the ornamental bat wings was twisted and half-melted, and of the air car itself, only the body remained. The interior appointments, the power plant, and the weaponry were all gone, and Dirk suspected the gravity grid would be missing as well, though he could not see the underside of the derelict. He walked around it once and passed on. The second air car he found was in even worse shape. In fact, it could hardly be called a car at all. Nothing remained but a bare metal frame and four rotting seats squatting in the midst of the tubing, a skeleton gutted even of its skin. Dirk passed by that one, too. The next two wrecks he came to were both intact, but ghosts. You could only guess that their owners had died here on Warlorn, and the air cars had waited in the depths of the city long after they had been forgotten, until all power was gone. He tried both of them, and neither responded to his touch and his tinkerings. The fifth car, by then a full hour had passed, responded much too quickly. Thoroughly Kavalar, the car was a stubby two-seater with short triangular wings that looked even more useless than the wings on other air cars of high Kavalan manufacture. It was all silver and white enamel, and the metal canopy was shaped to resemble a wolf's head. Laser cannon were mounted on both sides of the fuselage. The car was not locked. Dirk pushed up on the canopy, and it swung open easily. He climbed in, snapped it shut, and looked out of the wolf's great eyes with a wry smile on his face. Then he tried the controls. The air car still had full power. Frowning, he killed out power again and sat back to think. He had found the transportation he was looking for, if he dared to take it. But he could not fool himself. This car was not a derelict like the others he had discovered. Its condition was too good. No doubt it belonged to one of the other Kavalars still in Lartane. If colors meant anything, he wasn't sure about that, then it probably belonged to Lorimar or one of the other Braes. Taking it was not the safest course he could choose, not by a long margin. Dirk recognized the danger and considered it. Waiting did not appeal to him, but neither did the prospect of danger. Jan Vickery or no Jan Vickery, stealing an air car might just provoke the Braiths into action. Reluctantly, he swung back the canopy and climbed out. But no sooner had he emerged than he heard the voices. He eased the air car canopy down, and it closed with a faint but audible click. Dirk crouched and made for the safety of the shadows a few meters beyond the wolf car. He could hear the Kavalars talking and their footsteps noisily echoing long before he saw them. They were only two, but they sounded like 10. By the time they had moved into the light near the air car, Dirk was pressed flat against a niche in the garage wall, a small cavity full of hooks where tools had once been hung. He was not quite sure why he was hiding, but he was very glad of it. The things that Gwen and Jan had told him of the other residents of Lartane had not reassured him.
"Are you sure of all this, Breton?"
one of them, the taller, was saying as they came into sight. He was not Lorimar, but the resemblance was striking. This man had the same imposing height, the same tan and wrinkled face, but he ran more to fat than Lorimar Highbraith, and his hair was pure white where the others had been mostly grey, and he had a small toothbrush of a moustache. Both he and his companion wore short white jackets over pants and shirts of chameleon cloth that had darkened to near black in the dimness of the garage, and they both had lasers.
"Joseph would not jape me,"
the second Kavalar said in a voice that rasped like sandpaper. He was much shorter than the other man, close to Dirk's own height, and younger as well, very lean. His jacket had the sleeves cut off to display powerful brown arms and a thick iron and glowstone armlet. As he moved to the air car, he came full into the light for an instant and seemed to stare at the darkness where Dirk was hidden. He had only half a face. The rest was all twitching scar tissue. His left eye moved restlessly as his face turned, and Dirk saw the telltale fire, a glowstone set in an empty socket.
"How do you know this?" the older man said as the two paused briefly by the side of the wolf car. "Rosef is fond of japes." "I am not fond of japes," said the other, the one who had been called Breton. "Rosef might jape you or Lorimar, or even Pyre, but he dare not jape me. His voice was horribly unpleasant. There was a grating rawness to it that offended the ear. But with the scars as thick as they were up and down his neck, Dirk found it surprising that the man could talk at all. The taller Kevlar pushed up against the side of the wolf's head, but the canopy did not lift.
"Well, if this is truth, then we must hurry," he said querulously. The log, Bretan, the log."
One-eyed Bretan made an odd noise, partway between a grunt and a growl. He tried the canopy himself.
"My tain," he rasped. "I left the head slightly ajar. It only took a moment to come up and find you."
In the shadows, Dirk pressed back hard against the wall, and the hooks dug painfully into his back between the shoulder blades. Bretan frowned and knelt, while his older companion stood and looked puzzled. Then suddenly the Braith was standing again, and his laser pistol was snug in his right hand trained on Dirk. His glowstone eyes smoldered faintly.
"Come out and let us discover what you are," he announced. "The trail you left in the dust is very plain to see."
Dirk, silent, raised his hands above his head and emerged.
"Oh, Mokman," the taller Kevlar said. "Down here."
"No," Dirk said carefully. "Dirk Talarian." The tall one ignored him.
"This is rare good fortune," he said to his companion with the laser. "Those jelly men of Rosif's would have been poor prey at best. This one looks fit."
His young tain made the odd noise again, and the left side of his face twitched, but his laser hand was quite steady.
"No,"
he told the other Braith.
"Sadly, I do not think he is ours to hunt. This can only be the one that Lorimar spoke of."
He slid his laser pistol back into his holster and nodded at Dirk, a very slight and deliberate motion, more a shifting of his shoulders than of his head.
"You are grossly careless. The canopy locks automatically when full closed. It may be open from the inside, but..."
"I realize that now," Dirk said. He lowered his hands. "I was only looking for an abandoned car. I needed transportation."
"So you sought to steal our air car?"
"No."
"Yes."
The Kavalar's voice made every word a painful effort.
"You are Carariel of Iron Jade."
Dirk hesitated, his denial caught in his throat. Either answer seemed likely to get him into trouble.
"You have no answer to that,"
said the scarred one.
"Bretan," the other cautioned, "the Mogman's words are no matter to us. If Gentany High Arnjade names him Carariel, then such is truth. Such animals have no voice about their status. Whatever he might say cannot lift the name, so the reality is the same regardless. If we slay him, we have stolen Arnjade property, and they will surely issue challenge."
"I urge you to consider the possibilities, Chell,"
Bretan said.
"This one, this Dirk Talarian, he can be man or Mokman, Carariel of Iron Jade or not. Truth?"
"Truth. But he is no true man. Listen to me, my tame. You are young, but I know of these things from Kefi, long dead."
"Consider nonetheless, if he is Mokman, and the Iron Jades named him Carariel, then he is Carariel whether he admits it or not. But if that is truth, Chell, then you and I must go against the Iron Jades in duel. He was trying to steal from us, remember. If he is Iron Jade property, then that is an Iron Jade theft."
The big white-haired man nodded slowly, reluctantly.
"And if he is Mokman, but not Carariel, then we have no problem,"
Bretan continued.
"Since then, he may be hunted. And what if he is a true man, human as a highbond, and no Mokman at all?"
Chell was much slower than his tain. The old Kevlar frowned thoughtfully and said,
"Well, he is no female, so he cannot be owned, but if he is human, he must have a man's rights and a man's name."
"Truth,"
Bretan agreed. But he cannot be Corario, so his crime would be his alone. I would duel him, not Jantany High Andrade.
The Braith gave his strange grunt growl again. Chell was nodding, and Dirk was almost numb. The younger of the two hunters seemed to have worked things out with a nasty precision. Dirk had told both Vickery and Janicek in no uncertain terms that he rejected the tainted shield of their protection. At the time, it had been an easy enough thing to do. On sane worlds like Avalon, it would unquestionably have been the right thing as well. On Warlorn, things were not quite so clear.
"Where shall we take him?"
Chell said. The two Braiths spoke as if Dirk had no more volition than their aircar.
"We must take him to Jantany High Andrade and his Tain," Breton said in his sandpaper growl. "I know their tower by sight."
Briefly, Dirk considered running. It did not seem feasible. There were two of them with sidearms and even an aircar. He would not get far. "I'll come," he said when they started toward him. "I can show you the way." It seemed that he would be given some time to think in any event. The Braiths did not seem to know that Vickery and Janicek were already out at the City of the Starless Pool, no doubt trying to protect the hapless jelly children from the other hunters.
"Show us then," Chell said.
And Dirk, not knowing what else to do, led them toward the undertubes. On the way up, he reflected bitterly that all this had come about because he was tired of waiting. And now, it seemed, he would wait after all.